This is a fantastic podcast for anybody who's into workplace design or HR who's interested in the way of work and what the future's looking with AI. Tune on in.
Hi, Kaylee. Thank you so much for joining us today. Now, we're going to have a very interesting conversation about the future of work and AI and how things have sort of progressed and how certain things haven't progressed over the last sort of few years and what the next sort of 10 to 20 years is going to look like. Firstly, do you want to introduce yourself, where you are, and a bit about your background?
Thanks, Seton, so much for inviting me to join you. I'm really excited for this conversation. I always love to just have a chat about future work and technology and what's happening in the workplace. So my name is Kaylee Higgins. I am a workplace strategist with CBRE. I have been with CBRE for about 4.5 years now as part of the Pacific Workplace Consulting team. Prior to that, I spent around 20 years working as an architect and interior designer, primarily focused on workplace. And as part of that, I had a really significant sort of interest and background and involvement in digital design technologies as well, which has become something that sort of fed into the way I think about work and workplace.
Absolutely. And I think one of the interesting things we had as a bit of a pre-conversation is that often designers are designing workplaces, but the workplaces of a designer is often quite different to the workplace and how things operate for other people in different businesses. So do you want to talk us through a little bit about, you know, how you've sort of found that too, coming from the architecture and design side, where design and the approach that you've learned, and then coming into the consulting side, but with the property group, and what that's also looked like and how that sort of changed, I suppose, the approach that you might have as well, or how it's unique versus just purely a designer?
Yeah, absolutely. So I started my architectural career with GHD, who are better known as an engineering company, particularly at that time when I started in the late 90s. Today, they're multidisciplinary. But because of that, I was working in a much larger workplace with many more different sort of diverse groups of people than a lot of architects and designers are necessarily exposed to in their own way of working. So I think when I started working for GHD in Sydney, there was, you know, a headcount of over 200 people, and it included like all the corporate functions and IT departments and directors and sort of different people doing different things. And they didn't all come from the same sort of background and training. Whereas when you're working in an architecture studio, firstly, they do tend to be much smaller, even the largest architectural practices today, and not thousands and thousands of headcounts. A lot of them won't have a dedicated technology IT department. They don't necessarily, like a lot of them are under 50 people. And you might be working in an old warehouse and not in a big commercial corporate building. After leaving GHD, I spent about 10 years working in those types of practices and those types of environments. And one of the things I have come to learn is that, yeah, architects and designers historically have worked very differently to a lot of other corporate businesses. And so sometimes there can be a real lack of understanding around how lawyers work, how HR people work, how an IT department operates, and even the kind of groups that you get involved in the fit out and what their differing priorities are and how their budgets work and how they're kind of I suppose, bashing up against each other sometimes almost to solve these workplace problems. And it's interesting because I think today maybe in some ways the way that architects and designers work is getting closer to how other people work because we're all much more computer-based these days. Everyone is much more computer-based. But back, I guess, you know, 20 years ago, architects, even though we were working on software, we still spent a lot of time putting together physical samples, talking around big A1 printouts, whereas there's less and less of that even in architecture and design today than what there was. It was just every single project, every single minute, kind of almost 20 years ago. And so that led architects and designers to need different kinds of spaces. They wanted those collaborative open areas, the round tables, the lounges where you could present in front of someone. Now, like in an advertising agency, that sort of thing is going to be great too. But for your average corporate workplace, a lot of those spaces are the most underutilized spaces that we see consistently across big corporates. People are saying, well, this open table never gets used, this lounge never gets used. And often it's because they are placed too much amid workstations. And so if you have a group, and particularly a larger group, gathering right next to workstations, that's something that's actually quite distracting for the people working at the workstations. And I think even more so when we get into activity-based work environments where you may be sitting next to a team who have nothing to do with what you do, and therefore their kind of conversations are not important for you to overhear. They're quite distracting. If they're really, you know, collaborating, they can be quite noisy. And maybe they actually need to be somewhere, whether it's an enclosed room or just a separate space, not right alongside the workstations.
Well, because
that said, today, so much collaboration is online anyway.
Oh, absolutely. And that's the whole reason that people come into workplaces. So let's just have that a little bit of that discussion around the history of sort of work and how work has evolved to where we are. So we're doing this in 2026, right?
Yeah.
You know, if I think back, you know, even with lawyers and things like that, there was definitely closed spaces. As somebody who is neurodiverse and, you know, just didn't really realize how much effect those things, like even my partner and I were having a discussion about co-working. I'm like, it's an open mind. I'm like, this is just not going to work for me. Like, I work best in a small, contained, quiet space because if there's noise around, I can't think. But that's my dyslexia and my attuned to obviously right noise. Whereas my partner's like, great, there's hive and there's noise going on. I find it interesting because obviously we are all sitting on computers. Since COVID, there's obviously been more now where people used to go to people's offices and they go, well, why would I do that when I can just have that phone call and have that conversation and resolve that? If I think about, because I work a lot with architects and consultants, you know, there's a lot of PCGs that now used to be around. Everybody used to come into the boardroom, 30 people around. Now they'd just be online and they'd just be sorting it out. And obviously now with AI note takers, we all sort of have that preference too, because it's like, great, somebody's actually, it's recorded, so we don't have to have as many fights back and forth. So why are we still, firstly, can you take me through the history and evolution of work and how we've been working, but also then the history and evolution of how workplaces actually evolved and what the preferences has been and why those preferences have been the case? Because there's obviously a property element. There's also a design and collaboration element as well.
Yeah, so I think we often tend to think of the office as like it's always been there. But historically, the office is a 20th century invention, really. Yeah, there were 19th century offices, but it was really in the early 20th century that the idea of corporate work, as we know it today, started to develop. And the office was essentially a container for the things and the equipment that we needed to do our work. So it started out as a container for typewriters, for files, paperwork, and the people doing the work. And in some ways, it was a product also of the Industrial Revolution, particularly the open office, was like maximum efficiency. Like you look at some of the designs, say Frank Lloyd Wright from the 1920s, of these open plan offices, you could almost mistake them for today, except for the absence of monitors, of course. They're just like benches. And then, of course, the office did start to evolve, and particularly, I think, in the 80s and 90s, it really closely evolved in line with technology. So we evolved from the straight desks where people were writing, typewriting, et cetera, to the L-shaped desk to accommodate those big CRT monitors, and then into the linear desk that's really still remains that benching desk, the most common desking type today. But it seems particularly when it comes to the open office and the desking, we sort of got to 2005 or so, and that linear desk, which by 2010 was pretty much everywhere in Australia anyway, new fit outs. And we kind of stopped. We haven't actually gone to another evolution, which I find really interesting because the way that we use technology today is really super different to 20 years ago. So yes, okay, maybe the monitors don't look that different. We've got some bigger curved ones and more plethora of monitors. But we, you know, if I think back 20 years ago, we were still printing and filing emails. We were still primarily, we were meeting in person video conferencing was only just starting to become a thing, and you went to a specialized room to do a video conference. And there were a lot more meetings involving a lot more people. You did everything in person. If you went to a conference to see a speaker, you wouldn't get a recording. You wouldn't see the speaker on YouTube. Like, a lot of the way that we interact, consume media, and things has changed a lot. You didn't collaborate on the same file at the same time over the cloud. Like, you did your changes. You emailed it to someone who did their changes. Like, you probably actually then sat down and talked about it and maybe marked it up, as opposed to like pinging each other with comments in a file sharing platform or a collaboration platform like designers use. So the process of work has changed a lot. And I think there's a lot of times where our workflows and the way we work hasn't kept up. We kind of got into COVID and just replaced a physical meeting with a Teams meeting, and we're just having more and more meetings as well. And that was actually even the case pre-COVID, because there's more and more specialists, there's more and more people need to be, as you say, 30 people in a PCG, and we need everyone in the room always collaborating, to the point where people's jobs have literally become going to meetings and they don't have time to actually do any work at all.
I know, that is 100% true.
But at the same time, the office environment in many ways has been quite static. Like, yes, we have really improved in terms of well-being, in terms of like our expectation of entertainment and hospitality. Those kind of experience-based spaces have really elevated over the last 20 years. But they're actually spatially similar. They're still reception areas. My own is in the image behind me. There is still social kitchen hubs. And then there's meeting rooms and then there's desks. I think probably the big spatial typology that we've seen come out of COVID really taking off is the quiet room or the focus room, or we in CBRE call them jump rooms, the idea being that they're non-bookable, that it's not about necessarily a function for focus or quiet, but they might function. Maybe that's where you go to be noisy and do your Teams call, or maybe it's where you go to be quiet and do your focus work, but it is a room for one to three people. Because the other thing we've seen as an outcome of COVID is that while, yes, we might have more specialists and more people in the meetings, physically there's less people in the meetings. It's something like 90% of meetings today have three people or less physically present in a room. And that's based on data we're taking from utilization studies with our clients, but also I know XY Sense has very similar statistics as well. So we are putting in more and more of these small rooms. And so in some ways people say, oh, is that a return to the office, the enclosed office? But obviously they're typically smaller than offices. They're intended to be shared. It's not the intention that someone sits there all day, every day. But if someone needs to work in there for a whole day, why not? Like, if that's what is required for their job that day, if they're on calls all day, then it actually makes sense. Then they're not taking up a desk in the open plan area and that's available for someone else, given that we are all sharing. That's a big change, actually. The desk sharing is now.
And I mean, the tech that's coming along with that. And obviously, we're at a very interesting stage right now. You know, we're recording in July 2026. And the reason I mark the date is because by December 2026, things could be even different again at the mark.
Not in the workplaces, but in the world of AI.
Well, that's right. And what we're doing. So, for example, like I said to Maya, so, you know, we do a lot of work and we're doing a lot of work in the background and utilize AI in different ways to create things and automate things and create more value for people, right? But at the same time, it changes the way that you operate. So, yes, I mean, I have always been in meetings. I'm used to working in national environments. I'm used to working with people in here and then needing to work with people interstate. Sometimes it's like this, and obviously now I've created an environment where it is more one-on-one, or it's still a personal but it's a digital situation, and then in person is for other reasons and doing that. I think there's two things where I'm going with this. Firstly, let's just take a step back, and if we focus on probably the changes that came through COVID, and it's not COVID, it's probably that, you know, working from home became more of a normalcy, that people got used to working from home and then employers started to trust them to do so, that that visual communication or like Teams and Zooms and things like that became more normacy and more of an accepted way and a preference first. Obviously, that's also changed because, you know, for example, you're in New South Wales, I lived in Victoria during COVID. You know, it's become more of an expectation that where people want to work from home. And so we're talking also about a behavioral change in the things that we do. So if I'm in an office or if I run my business now, but if I'm back working for somebody, I would have the days that they're my working from home days. They're the things that I do on those dates and they're all blocked out in my calendar. And the days when I'm in the office, they're the things that I'm doing. So the day is generally an HR person, is you connecting with people and you doing those things. If it's in other parts, it's collaborating, going to meetings, dealing with clients. And so that behavior changes. And it's interesting because now we have more hybrid work happening. We then obviously have a reduction in lettable space, but a higher use of companies that can use or employees to that space. So if obviously the data around government is like, they find like 40% of their, it's being utilized, more of that too, because the ratio, whereas I think it used to be about 60%. Obviously, you're the data expert more on this side of things, but I'm interested to explore that, what we've sort of seen since, I suppose, this emergence up to, you know, AI has obviously been continuing and now the next sort of 5 years to 2030, I think we all don't know exactly where it's going to head, but there's, I'll talk about some of the behaviors with that. So can you talk about how that sort of also changed not only within the design of workplace, but the patterns of work? And obviously you as a designer and me as an HR person, what we're seeing and how that crossover also occurs within policies, technology, and then workplace design.
Yeah, and I think you're right in that in a lot of ways, it wasn't necessarily that all of this was caused by COVID. It was a development of things that had started to happen, and particularly COVID accelerated the work from home proportion, and it accelerated the development and the uptake of tools like Zoom and Teams and the chat tools as well, Slack, Teams, you know, those sorts of things. I think another thing that has come out of COVID partially, and you alluded to as well, is the nature of dispersed teams, and that more and more people today work in teams where their colleagues, particularly if you are in a large corporate, where their colleagues are not physically present with them. And that's, I think, another often difference between a smaller business versus a large corporate. Like very few people in a large corporate necessarily work day to day with people that are physically based with them. Their boss might be in a different state. Their team member might be in a different state. Their client might be in a different state. And there's definitely a lot more acceptance from clients that you don't need to be traveling all the time and that you can deliver projects utilizing the best expertise you have from around the country without, because I remember there used to always be this kind of fear on the client's part. If you put someone in a proposal that wasn't physically based in that state, they'd think, oh, is that person really going to turn up? Are they really going to travel? And they'd always question you about it. Whereas today, there's absolutely no problem with that. I'm working across Australia with projects in almost every state and, you know, I don't travel very regularly. I might have colleagues who are on the ground meeting with the client in person, but I might be joining via video like this. And I think that's a big impact as well, because then you have people say, well, why will I come to the office to spend all my day on Teams calls? Because unfortunately for a lot of jobs, you can't neatly segment your focus time, your alone time and your meeting time and things. It's, so even though you're in the office on a certain day, you still need to do a Teams call or you need to do some focus work, work on a proposal or a report. And so we did see, particularly early on, a lot of frustration of people saying, why am I coming to the office just to be on calls? And none of my colleagues are here. And what's the point? And I think it does depend a lot on your job and your role. And companies are finding different ways around this. So, for example, at CBRE, our kind of, we don't have a mandate about how many days we spend in the office. It's very much a team-based kind of approach. It's supposed to be clients first, team second, individuals third. And Great. So depending on your role, if your role is as a property manager and you're on site at a building, well, you've got to be there 5 days a week. Like, that's the expectation. Yeah. Whereas in my role where I'm working nationally, I do a lot of Teams calls. My team is based around Australia and New Zealand, and the people I'm working with might be anywhere. There's less need for me to be in the office as much as some of my colleagues are. Yeah. So I think it's hard though then, because you do see teams where there's attention, you know, between attendance. And you see the same with a lot of clients who have frontline workers who do need to be in the workplace and have back of house corporate workers who can work from home. However, there's a lot of studies that say actually what people value the most is flexibility and certainty. So that they have flexibility and choice around, you know, how their shifts work and things like this. And that if they're, as particularly if they're like casual shift based, that they have certainty that they'll get the amount of hours that they want. And that's actually more important, because a lot of the people who work in jobs where they're not sitting at a desk or computer all day, there's some people who maybe haven't made that choice, but there are a lot of people who've chosen that path because they don't want to sit in a corporate office at a desk all day.
Yeah. Well, and that's right. I mean, when you talk about those two elements of certainty and flexibility or autonomy, I mean, that's how the human brain works. You know, heaps of behavioural studies have been done that we like to know, is this for certain, is this? But we also like to feel like we've got autonomy. And obviously with new psych safety laws coming in, there's a lot around that too that I sort of just look at and I go, yep, everybody's still working out what does that mean in my context of my organization. But also it's like it just works into human behavior, and there's been so many studies done, so many in organizations, that obviously you just get so much more output. You've still got to have the right characteristics and the right values within your organization. The general simple principles that you've got there as your guiding principles, and if they're not performing or coming up or able to actually, you know, work within their role effectively, then that becomes a performance issue. But giving people that autonomy and that choice, generally you will get a lot more out of. You know, it's this funny thing that we still 100%. All, it's an 8-hour day, 5 days a week, which we know legally is 38 hours and 7.6 hours. But in essence, whatever you do at the end of the day, somebody can spend 8 hours, or if they are more engaged and able to do, they can produce a lot less. That's probably a perfect segue onto where we are going next, because obviously the world of work is changing, and it's changing rapidly, particularly for office workers, with obviously the emergence of AI being able to potentially automate or assist. So productivity will change enormously as well. You know, there's things that I love about AI, that it can be working overnight while I'm sleeping and my team's doing something, right? It's doing the grunt work that would be repetitive stuff that would be very difficult for somebody to do and quite brain numbing. But it's there and it's operating. But at the same time, it's obviously changing the way we're working. So if I look at it, you know, there's tech out there. I'm pretty much now, and obviously dyslexic, I can type quite fast and it's fine. But I will generally just talk to my AI. So it's not just in meetings I'm talking. I'm often just consciousness done. And that behavior has even changed in the last 12 months to 18 months with AI too. And, you know, you've got technology like Whisper Throw and things like that, where I feel like we're actually now integrating and talking to technology into what we've been doing for millennia. For our entire existence as human beings, we have communicated verbally. How is this potentially also going to change the way that we work and what you predict, and how we need to be thinking about that in workplace design moving forward?
Yeah, there's so much really to unpack in terms of AI at the moment. I think everyone is really grappling with what is the future and how fast it's changing. But I also think there's not really the proven productivity impacts yet. And there's a lot of testing, experimenting, and then I start to wonder, is AI just allowing us to produce more stuff, more words, more meeting notes, more outputs, more emails that then we have, or more meetings that our bots can go to? And then we have to, who's consuming that as well? So I think there's a lot we're still working out as to where the power of AI is actually going to be. Because oftentimes the stuff that it's most powerful at right now is not the basic grunt work automation, but creative thinking, writing, brainstorming, which is kind of weird. It's not where I expected technology to go, and I don't think a lot of people did. I thought we could automate, you know, designing a fire stair or a disabled toilet faster because it's very rules-based, but we're still grappling with some of those basic problems.
How everybody else may be using AI, but from a design perspective, I agree with you. Like, it seems like AI has come more in the front end, the iterations, the design on that side. And the banking compliance stuff, like, seems to be a bit harder. And I think that's actually where people have gone, oh, the flashy stuff, cool, great. Yeah. This is, you know, the difficult part. And I also think that might also be because it has to integrate into technology and they may not have opened it up as well.
Yeah.
So it can be a bit easier potentially for companies to do that versus waiting for Autodesk to potentially allow things to come in and do. But again, I, from a purely design point of view, I agree. I'm hearing so much on the designs. I'm like, but wouldn't it have just been, so much better in the documentation stage? But from a, probably from a typical, office worker, or let's say a, you know, white collar worker who's doing something, you know, these things are changing rapidly. And it's also, I think, people experimenting with it and what it can do. I mean, I spend a lot of time every day working out how can we do this, what is this better. And as you said, most of it is experimenting. Obviously, I run a small business. You're part of a large global business. It's so very different.
There's a big gap apparently between implementation at enterprise level and small businesses. And I've heard small businesses are actually succeeding much more so than enterprise because there's more control. Like when you're in an enterprise, you're locked into your sandbox systems and you can't necessarily just pick the best tool for the job and things. You might not have as much opportunity to experiment. And so there's a lot of research that's actually saying the team level is going to become a really important part of actually improving AI productivity and working together as teams to teach, learn, share solutions, share agents. I would say most people are still just using AI to improve their emails and reports and, you know, maybe take meeting notes, a bit of brainstorming. People aren't, there aren't a lot of people I would say that I see or talk to that are building their own agents unless they're like really kind of into tech and experimenting. So they're still in that smaller early adopter group, I think.
The small businesses, we're enabled to be able to experiment and we're having the same conversation. This, we're getting slight off the topic with workplace, but definitely it's one of those interesting things that for small to medium-sized businesses, if the founders are actually taking the time and doing it, but again, like even myself, I'll take it to a certain point and then I just don't have the personality type to sit there. Whereas my partner is operations tech mad. It's like, oh my God, I'm so excited. It's like, that sounds fantastic. If I can't do that in an hour, I'm done. I'm bored, right? But that might be the ADHD brain in me. Whereas, you know, we obviously, you know, experiment in the same way. We're coding and doing lots of things and creating, enabling us to actually do those different parts. But it's a lot of learning along the way to do it. And as they're saying now, it's predicted that the first billion income turnover one person organizations will happen. It was predicted last year. It's obviously taking a little bit longer, the full automation. So, you know, my partner has essentially started a company and I have an employee model and she's just gone, how much now can I run in agents to do each element of this? So from our point of view, it's not about using AI. It now becomes about what value can you provide to somebody and how now does that become your particular IP because you've worked out that way of working. Whereas, you know, for the last 100 years, that IP has taken a lot longer to be able to create and to implement. But at the end of the day, everything still comes from what's the problem you're trying to solve, what's the best way of solving that, and how do you create value to the people that you're helping within it. So I think that's where it's also really interesting for you and I to have this conversation because I'm like, you know, micro business able to do those things, working with small to medium sized businesses. Yes. You're in a large corporate working with really large corporates. And I'm fascinated to see how, you know, I run a remote first business where we also use technology like async tech. So we can run and be working. I have a fully flexed team where everybody works on different hours. And, you know, we'll use technology like, it's now owned by Atlassian, but Looms, where we will record and do things and then send them to improve those productivity. So I can have my focus time on certain things and then my team can have focus time. But I find it fascinating because also I come back in and I look at how burnt out I was working in organizations going from this and that. You talk about people not doing agents. You know, we're engaged to train people how to use their agents in Microsoft Office 365. And I was like, it's not really that hard, but it was the conversation with the AI implementers was, it's not that hard, but the problem is that when you're internal, you are dragged from pillar to post to all these things. It's just having the mental time to be able to engage in that and learn what that skill is to do it is a big change. So I think we see some of us at this end of the curve and we're trying to keep ahead of it as a competitive edge. But I think in 6 to 12 months time, those types of things will become quite normal. The other thing is the AI is now making it easier too. Unless you're using Microsoft Copilot, to create an agent these days is turning into as quickly as being able to have a chat to do it. I think it'll be interesting how we see the emergence. And I think everybody's sort of sitting there going, how automated is this going to get? But at the same time, where is the value to be able to keep that? So tell me a little bit about sort of what you're seeing from the corporate level, because I've just given you the...
Oh my gosh, yeah, you just touched on so many things. So in terms of the number of people in a business, that's a big discussion. Because obviously we're forward planning with clients for 5 to 10 to 15 years even. And, you know, 10 years ago you could have said to a big business, how many people will you have in 5 years' time? And they'd have spreadsheets and business plans. And they'd
have workforce planning.
Answers, right? And while they now still have workforce plans, they might have 3 different models in there. And you're like, how do we create a workplace that might cater for like 500 people versus 2,500 people? Like, there can be such variance across headcount modeling. And I think no one knows where AI is going to go in terms of how businesses operate, how they work with their headcounts. We've seen over the last, I'd say, 5 years in Australia, quite significant growth in headcounts in a lot of the corporate organisations that we work with. And initially we saw them absorbing these headcounts often into their space. So while there was a lot of talk of downsizing after COVID, there were a lot of people that didn't necessarily downsize as much, but they just absorbed more and more and more people into their existing fit-outs. Yeah. To the point they come to us, maybe it's a lease expiry event and they think, oh, maybe we'll downsize because we haven't downsized after COVID. And we're like, but you've added 40% more people into the building. So you actually need more space, not less. And you don't have enough focus rooms typically because, you know, that wasn't what people were building. They just kept adding desks and desks for a while. So I think there's a lot of uncertainty around headcount and around that future. And the idea of planning for a 10-year scenario is a big challenge for businesses, and not just around headcount and real estate. Like, there's so much sort of uncertainty and chaos in the world, in the geopolitical climate, with AI, et cetera. It's creating a lot of business uncertainty generally.
Absolutely.
So I think that's definitely a big impact.
Can I just take a step back there just to understand? So generally, if you were talking about a person per square meter and what the utilization of, like, let's say a desk or an area would be, now what are we talking in leasing space per head? Obviously, it's different for different types of businesses, but is there a typical ratio what was sort of in the teens, the 20 teens versus the 20s now, and then because we just talked about that, the dynamics of people working from home more, the dynamics of now, because the entire workspace and what you're doing in zoning must be changing, as you said, more entertaining yeah. areas, because that's where people are coming to the office now to talk, entertain, to impress a client, whatever, I'm assuming that's it. Can you go into that a little bit, and then what that's sort of looking like? As you said, if they're absorbing 40% more people, that must mean there's less usage per head of the offices.
Yeah, so I think, you know, space per desk hasn't necessarily changed, but the number of employees per desk is a bit different.
Yeah.
We are actually probably seeing space per desk drop a bit. It got very dense, what we would consider very dense in Australia. Obviously, it's under the building code, it's one desk per 10 metres squared. Any workplace that is designed to that or less, which call centres can be, is likely to actually feel very crowded, and it's not an enjoyable experience to be at those desks. Noise is going to be a big complaint. So we encourage clients generally, you know, it's an individual approach for every client, but we would generally say don't push it to that level. Think about instead your desk sharing ratios. So one-to-one assigned desking is very rare in Australia today, whereas I would say it was still probably the dominant model pre-COVID, despite the prevalence of activity-based working. Australia was a really early adopter and a significant adopter of activity-based working prior to COVID. The fact we had activity-based working even in government was amazing compared to other countries. It's very rare to see assigned seating in large.
Take more on moments, just for those who aren't designers and know how to do that speak. So let's explain what activity-based working is firstly, and then let's go back to those sort of ratios and how's that changed, because it's also a difference in what we're using per space as well. So
activity-based working often gets described as hot desking, which is actually, we would consider them different things as designers or workplace strategists. So they're both based around the idea that you share desks and that you don't have a permanent assigned desk where you go to sit every day. There are different models by which you could manage that, neighbourhoods for teams, different booking systems, many different approaches, and it depends on the individual organisation. Hot desking, we would consider that to be the free-for-all. Literally, that's where you turn up. You can't find a desk. You could be sitting anywhere. However, a well-designed, well-structured and managed activity-based work program will include a variety of what we call work settings. So there are desks with monitors. There are other tables at which you can work with a laptop. There are the small rooms you can work in. There are generous social spaces, meeting rooms, etc. And you certainly, for a well-designed activity-based office, you're certainly not at 1 per 10 square meter per desk. And then the desk sharing ratios vary as well and should be designed based upon how the occupancy patterns work for that individual company, taking into account any mandates or days per week employees are expected in the workplace, and then considering actual occupancy data and trends, ideally. And they also should take into account like booking systems and how they're going to be managed. So what we see in Australia is a variety of, desk sharing ratios, so desks per employee. So we might see anything from, say, one desk per 1.2 employees. So that's quite a low sharing ratio. That's something that you actually probably could have had pre-COVID, because you've always got to take into account the fact there's always people on annual leave, sick leave, traveling, in a meeting. But today we see clients push it as far as maybe one desk per 3 employees. And so they might have a high proportion of employees who travel, a high proportion of employees who work remotely, different sort of setups. So they don't need as many desks every day. But one of the things we are learning is you still want to be able to have teams get together and teams work together on the same day. And I do think one of the spaces that we are missing in today's workplace is really team-based spaces. Spaces where teams know they'll find the rest of their team, where they can get together and work together as a team. The idea of, we call it working alone together, where you're working on your work and there's people around you doing what you do. So you might be, you know, called upon or join a conversation. but you are sort of with the people, whether that's your department or project team, but it's the people that you actually work with, not just the people who are in the same company as you.
Well, and then that's the driver too, because nobody wants to come in. Particularly, I think the other change has been too, is that most people would now have a home office set up, probably if they were in Melbourne and Sydney in particular, because you had to really get that sorted during COVID. I think, you know, with WHS checks and things that we're doing, there's not many people, I think, that still just have work off the kitchen table. Some might, right? Yeah. But I think, I don't know, do you, is there sort of any evidence of things like that, that now people more have, there's a higher proportion of people who now have a proper home desk set up. So when they go into the office, then they don't want to be, this is always probably one of my things too. It's like if you go in and you've got, I've got two massive screens and a desk and a sit to stand desk and everything set up perfectly. And then you go into the office and then you're just stuck working on your laptop in a corner because you can't get a desk and you're not near your team. That doesn't make the experience of wanting to come into the office very pleasurable at all either.
Absolutely. And there's a fear in corporate Australia that we won't have enough desks with monitors. It's a constant thing that we have conversations about, comes up at conferences all the time as well, that there is this issue that, yes, everyone expects to have that fully ergonomic setup with the monitors when they come to the office. But the problem is if you provide enough monitors and desks for that peak day, then there's going to be a whole lot of desks that are barely ever used because often you're peak days can differ quite considerably. So we put a lot of, I guess, time and thought into how we structure different occupancy models that we put forward for discussion with clients so that we can find the right approach for their organisation. And they are very different approaches, as I've said. So the number of employees can really vary. So a great example is, in fact, the office I'm sitting in today, CBRE Sydney office. So we've been in this building for over 15 years and we decided to renew our lease and to stay put on the three floors that we have here at 363 George Street. We didn't take any extra space and we completely gutted and started again in terms of the fit out. We accommodate a larger headcount here than we did in the past, but we also have a much more significant space for training, more significant client business lounge, a larger social area. And so we've more small meeting rooms. We've kind of got more of everything except desks. We do have less desks for more headcount, but we manage that through team neighbourhoods and we've done a post-occupancy utilisation study so we can see where spaces are being used, where they're not, and kind of tweak at the edges of that.
And I think that's actually one of the most important things too, because I often see designers design spaces and it's because the fee, particularly for designers, it's like there, but the post-occupancy is like this extra fee at the end. It's like, but if you don't do that, where are you taking the learnings? It was what we actually designed going to work. And I suppose that's where the idea of something and then the reality of how it works and being able to make those tweaks, whereas I suppose having your own, being able to do that and you know, being a property company yourselves, you can sort of move those things around or make those tweaks and changes. How much do you learn from those post-occupancy surveys?
Oh, so it was really amazing. We did a very extensive post-occupancy process here, surveys, utilization study, interviews, and the workplace satisfaction has gone up incredibly. We use a net promoter score to measure workplace satisfaction, and it went up, I think it was close to 70 points that it went up. So, yeah. It was phenomenal.
That's incredible. And I'm assuming that's one of the things you really talk to your clients about too, is just the importance of being able to do that, because it's at the end of the day, you make a massive investment of these things, particularly if you're leasing, and obviously that's what you guys do as well, you know, how important that is too, to be able to create value onto the reason for investing that much in.
Absolutely. Our workplace strategy and our engagement strategy was very much linked to our business strategy and what we wanted the workplace to achieve in order to support the business and to create connection across our teams, to create better connection with our clients. And so it really, you know, in some ways we could describe the whole process of the project as a connection strategy rather than a workplace strategy.
Yeah, absolutely. So. Brilliant. Well, it sounds, I mean, that's where you have an incredible point, not just being a workplace strategist and designer, but also working in a property company and seeing both of those elements, I think is the unique part of what you bring to that. You also run your own newsletter as well. So do you want to tell us a little bit about that and tell us a little bit? It's been running for quite a few years and you share a lot of your thoughts in that as well.
Yeah, so I write a blog. It's called The Midnight Lunch. And I started writing that in 2013. So I write with different frequency about different things. Over the years, it really has, I guess, evolved from initially probably talking about workplace and architecture to now I describe it as the intersection of work, technology and design and sort of those issues. I have recently written a piece on AI and what that impact might be on the workplace. And we sort of touched on a few of those things today, but we didn't really dive deep yet into that, the voice activated part. And that was something that really started to catch my mind last year is like, what is the impact going to be on the office if we all start talking to our computers? Yes. Like, how does the open plan start to survive us all, all day at our computers? What if we get to the point where we don't really use keyboards anymore? And then I started to think about other technology and, like, in particular, as we touched on, the monitor is really this key piece of hardware that people are fixated upon, and rightly so. It's ergonomic, it's necessary, it really helps you, especially, you know, if you need glasses and can't see on your laptop, to have those big monitors. It's great to have screens in meeting rooms and all of this, but it's really the last piece of physical hardware that we're tied to. Like, everything else is mobile. Those screens are the only thing that's left. And I think if we start to think about what the new technologies are that are out there, and they're already existing things where you can project onto walls, holograms, like all sorts of things.
Very true. That you can literally take with you this big.
Yeah. That's right. And they're just, you can buy one of them, I think, for $100 on Amazon or something.
And my partner's just got a fold-up screen to go. So when she's working in, you know, clients' offices, I've seen she's those. Just like, you know, it's three, get them on Amazon three, not quite that one, but just went with the quick fold because you can get on the plane, you can do that. And obviously it's about productivity. So if you've got something going on, particularly now with coding, you've got something going on here, you're seeing the reality of it over here. But I think this, now we're talking to our computers, just like we would be talking, you and I having conversation now.
And I think it, like if we start to say, oh, we're talking all the time and we don't need monitors anymore, then that really opens up what is the desk. And it doesn't mean we won't have tables. I'm not saying that we'll have an office full of just like bin bags or something, but we'll still need work surfaces and tables. We'll still meet, but we might be doing so in different ways, and we might maybe unlock a lot of potential in the space, because we are still, whilst the proportion of space allocated to desks has really dropped, we are allocating, you know, a lot higher proportion to shared space, but we are still allocating the significant proportion of most corporate workplaces.
That is very true.
Desks. Yeah. And those desks are often sitting empty much of the day because our employees are either working from home or they're out visiting clients, having meetings, they're in a small room talking to someone on a call. So I think there's a lot of potential for the next kind of round of technology changes to actually significantly impact what the office could be. Obviously, it takes time. It takes 5 to 10 year leasing cycles for these things to really fully play out.
Isn't it fascinating though? Because you're talking about on leasing cycles, whereas, you know, you can look at it if for small and medium size, you know, depending on what they're doing in space. But I always talk about things as systems, right? Like, you know, the technology in the workplace may change quicker than that leasing cycle is actually happening. So is that something that you think too, things might become a bit more agile in the design so they can be changed and reiterated quicker even?
Well, it's interesting, right? Because I think about how would we reuse this open plan office space if we didn't have the monitors and things. But it kind of, the way we've designed it, we could easily take the desks out, but what would we replace it with? Because we don't want to go back to like offices all along the windows and just all enclosed rooms either. So I think there's a lot of opportunity for some interesting things and design.
And I think the purpose of the office is changing, essentially what you're saying. You don't go to the office necessarily to do sit down computer work. That might be an element of what you're doing.
Yes.
We're becoming a lot more agile. And even the other thing is, like, now I can do half of my stuff just on my phone, right? Yep. Like, even that, like, my partner's built out entire things, you know, and works with lots of trades. They're not going to be sitting down at a computer. They literally just want to talk to her and go, hey, I've got this update, da-da-da-da. Like, I literally will be just talking to my AI and giving in instructions. We need this, can you do this, right?
And so then this will blow the brains of architects listening to this. But when I finished as an architect, I was a project architect running like $60 million building refurb. I could work off my iPad. I had Fujitsu cloud-based collaboration software on my iPad. I had Excel on my iPad, email on my iPad.
Yeah.
The only thing that I couldn't do was the InDesign for the proposals. But, you know, like, you could coordinate with someone else who was sitting in a PC who could do that.
Yeah.
Like, this is the thing, right? Slower than the technology, slower than the lease cycles is the humans. The humans are the slowest, the change. And this is one of the reasons I think we haven't seen uptake of autonomous vehicles, for example, because as humans, we don't want that. It.
We do need it. I was stuck on the M1 the other day. And I thought, if I had a Tesla right now, I'd be sitting here pretty. This is ridiculous. They need to legalize this. It's been in place for 10 years. Let's make this shit happen. Like,
so my daughter is with you.
There is a bit of a fear, although I do have a counter to that. If, and I mean, it is a bit of a, it's a negative counter, I suppose. If we look at, let's take the iPhone or smartphones, right? Back 2008, I think they kind of came into emergence. I remember my partner had the first sort of one. And we now look at how that has fundamentally changed our behavior. I think, you know, when we talk about social media and how that's also changed and now it's there, I actually do think human behavior is changing. Actually quite rapidly. And I think the way that AI is working, and I've been observing this over the last few years, is actually what we do and what our expectations is. So even 12 months ago, most people would Google search, whereas now most people will chatty, AI, Gemini, they won't even bother to put it in. And I don't have the data on this, but I'm sure there is lots of studies of what the uptake has been in what people are doing. And I've been watching this because when you run a business, you got to think SEO, this, then you're like, okay, like, what do I do and transfer? In 12 months, the fundamental changes that have happened, the fundamental changes that I know in my behavior, and then I see in the consistent conversations with friends and how they're behaving, people sort of try it out and then they do it and they're like, oh, I can do this and they can do this. You know, like, now you don't need to go to Coles. You can just have it set up. You can AI agent that into it. You can say, we're missing milk, add that to the shopping list for me. You know, going to. This technology probably has already existed for 10 years, you know, with Alexa and things like that. But now the piece is the connection piece that is happening in between. And I actually predict in 3 years, our behavior will actually change quite dramatically.
I think that's true. And I think what happens with a lot of technologies is that there's a tipping point where it just suddenly, like, really cascades quickly. I also think with the phone and social media, there's probably an addictive element that plays into that as well.
That's the dopamine levels and things that. Yeah, yeah. But there is definitely an AI element. I'll be interested to see how this is playing on our neuroscience of our brains and stuff. But those studies are happening.
But I think one of the things that doesn't change really, and which we've kind of touched on throughout this conversation, is the human need to connect and to gather and to be with other people. And that digital, while it's efficient and effective sometimes, you still want to be in person at times.
Our brains need it, the serotonin levels, the chemicals that we need are that. And that's why I think workplace is changing. The purpose of what the office is fundamentally changed.
And one of the things I touched on earlier was around that need for spaces for teams to gather. And there's actually a really interesting example that I've seen recently coming out of LinkedIn doing pilot study, creating an AI-enabled team space. So the engineering teams, which they call pods, have a group that's for 6 or 10 engineers, software engineers. And as I understand it, I haven't seen any photos, I've only seen it described. It's some desks and a meeting room that are like owned by the team essentially, or bookable by the team.
Yeah.
And the meeting room is fully AI enabled, that you can walk in and say to the meeting room, hey, bring up what we were last working on. And then you can interact like using voice commands with the meeting room. I assume it still probably has traditional screens, but it's a super interesting, I think, convergence of that kind of team connection, collaboration piece and the AI. And, you know, one assumes you can also bring people in virtually to that environment very easily. And obviously, though, interestingly, it's still around the idea of synchronous work versus async. So, you know, but again, I don't think everyone is going to work remote and async all the time, because there's people who do like that. But as I said, this human needs.
And I was actually thinking about this morning too. I was thinking, you know, with my team, I'm like, and I was, you know, was working with an employee who was feeling quite isolated in their role, you know, not being part of where the others were. But I think it's also about equality. It's also about them, what the person's seeking, right? Like for me, you know, when you've got young kids and you've got that, what matters more is the ability to go and pick them up versus later on where it is. And it's been interesting for me too, going from being in an office, massive extrovert, need to connect with people, of watching myself even psychologically with those elements. But it is that ability to humanly connect that we need and that we do. I might be fortunate enough that I have that in the job and what I do. But at the same time, there are people who do want more outputs and do that. And I think it's also, we obviously now live in a time where people feel more isolated than they've ever felt, but we're more connected than where we ever are. But still, the elements of how our brain works and how things are has not actually fundamentally changed since we've evolved, right? And so now the way we work, the way we interact, even the schooling system, you know, I look at my kids and I think this is not, you know, nobody's really going to work in the same way that you're just going to turn up. You know, my son might be ADHD and dyslexic too, and I'm like, it doesn't matter, mate, because you're not me having to hand write. You need to learn how to do that, but you'll be able to just talk to whatever you're doing and it's going to do it. So things are fundamentally changing, but that ability to connect and community is really important. So from an HR perspective, that ability to have identity and feel part of something. And that's where now I think workplaces have always been really important, but the nature of work has changed. And now it actually comes to, how do we create those connections of what we need? How do we still get outputs and use humans to the best ability? Where we are and the way we work in 5 to 10 years' time, I think will fundamentally be different. But I think what we all have worked out is really AI is turning into tools and different ways of working and being able to deliver work. But in essence, we still want to connect with people. We still, particularly in the built environment, that is not changing, because somebody has to build the building. Somebody needs to be aware. As much as, you know, white collar work may change dramatically, the elements of what needs to be built, what needs to actually tangibly be touched, doesn't change.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, a lot of companies have realized that you can build culture remotely, but I think in the past, sometimes companies took culture for granted. And I remember working in one company where they said something like, we don't have a culture. And it was like, well, yes, you do. If you don't deliberately build a culture, you have the culture that happens. Like, there is still culture, whether you go about deliberately building it or not. You know, this, you know. Yeah. And I think that today there's much more focus from organizations at all scales of deliberately, you know, building the culture that they want to have and being more aware of that. And I think the more remote you are, the more time you spend away from people, whether that's because you work in different states or because you work a lot from home, you actually have to be more intentional about building culture. But I actually think there's a lot of benefits to intentionality in general, because I feel like intentionality supports people who work part-time. Intentionality supports people who are stressed out by last-minute changes. Intentionality can support learning and development, even if you're not face-to-face. I'm actually not a big fan of the idea of learning by osmosis, because I think that sometimes we are now expecting too much of that and not spending enough time actually talking to people who are learning, people who are graduates, people who are new in their roles, and teaching them. And, you know, we're just expecting them to overhear things. But how are they going to overhear if I'm typing emails and I'm on calls in rooms all day? I have to invite them into that to be part of that.
Yeah, if you're in a pod most of the time, half of those conversations might be happening, or you're on a phone booth or something like that. And I agree. I think the next generation, we've had that conversation with others, particularly designers, of what does that look like as AI might do more menial tasks that people may have learned as they've gone up.
Mm-hmm.
How does the craft not change? I think the one thing that isn't changing is the people skills and the ability to interconnect and do that, to be able to plan. I think the most important thing you can learn these days is actually how people work, how the brain works, how we interact, what our innate needs are and what makes us us. Those fundamental patterns haven't changed, and our brain hasn't evolved with the pace at which our life has changed. So we still have those innate needs, but the way that things operate is different. And I think the next generation
can improve. And, yeah, the ability to connect with people and communicate with people. And even if you've got AI, you know, doing some writing for you, you still need to find your voice and to edit the AI, because otherwise, you know, honestly, if you read AI that's not edited, you know, it's got its own style. And unless you edit it to be you, it never finds your voice. The more you use it, the more it can help you.
Yeah, it can do that.
I get my grad to check the AI's output. That's often what I get him to do to help him learn. He has to check the really detailed checking of like the data analytics and things.
I feel like our jobs have now become more QA checking than they are at actually producing sometimes, and depending on what you're doing. But it's an interesting one.
That was the job of a project architect too.
That's right. That is very true. So, Kelly, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a really interesting conversation, and I'm sure we could keep chatting for hours.
It feels like it.
Yeah, I know. Absolutely. I love it when you have a meeting of minds, and very interesting. And thank you for taking us through things that some people may know and some people may not know. So in regards to, obviously, we always ask people generally at the end, you know, is there a book or a podcast or anything? Firstly, we obviously want to promote that people sign up for your blog, newsletter. It sounds like very interesting, as we've had a great discussion today. You're thinking about things, you're thinking about what the future is. So definitely one to check out. Is there anybody else or anything that you find quite interesting you think that's worth sharing?
Oh, there's so much on Substack these days. A lot of people are like, oh, do you have a Substack? I'm like, no, I've had my own website for over 10 years. I would have got a Substack if I was starting today. I love Phil Kirshner, Brian Elliott, Nick Bloom, Bruce Daisley. There's a few really interesting, and if you start following them, then you will find others to follow as well.
Yeah, and I do love that element. We will get some of those people and note them in the show notes as well, and definitely send a link to yours. So, and if anybody wants,
plug as well for Cornet Australia, if you're in commercial real estate and fit out. I'm the part of the executive. I'm the chair of the Cornet Conference. And the events that Cornet put on always have fantastic quality speakers, great education.
Brilliant. And that's mainly on workplace and future of work, is it?
Yeah, that's right. So it's commercial real estate. So it does touch sometimes on some other aspects of commercial, retail, industrial, but it is very workplace focused.
Yeah, great. Well, we'll definitely include that in there as well. And absolutely. Thank you so much for all of your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Seton. It's been a great conversation.
Brilliant. Honestly, I think we could have kept talking for hours. Very, very interesting. And I'm sure we will have another conversation on diversity, inclusion, neurodiversity as well. I hope you enjoyed this. Please check out her newsletter. And if you're interested in engaging with her, please just click on all of the links below.